Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 125, being recorded on the 27th of April, 2016. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale and Evan. And good to have you guys both on the show. It's good to have a nice show with all three of us. So let's we got a bunch of topics we want to cover today. No specific theme for the day, but there's a lot of things to discuss. We do have a couple of items we want to dig into, and we'll get to that in a minute. But Kale, as usual, was nice enough to put together some of the recent updates in the Azure space in our internal show notes, so we can just start with that as usual. So, Kale, which one do you like in this list? You got a few here.
Probably the first one would be DocumentDB again. There's been a blog post out there about partition collections, which is kind of a thing that if you want to start scaling DocumentDB beyond just kind of a POC or just trying it out, if you actually want to run some serious load through there with lots of throughput and terabytes of storage, you're going to have to deal with partitions. And so one of the things that we did in the past with that, if you've used DocumentDB, is partitioning is essentially kind of like a sharding type algorithm that we can run across, and we can define how that sharding algorithm works, whether it's like hash-based to keep everything kind of even, or range-based based on some metric that we pick. But it was client-side before, right? So you could control this yourself. You could set the way you wanted to do it. We actually have another offering now, which is more server-side. So you can basically have the server do that work for you as opposed to you having to kind of define that. And so it just makes it simpler for you to be able to make very large, collections or be able to span these things and make them huge with maximum amounts of throughput.
So that would say, Kale, then that really then if with this capability, the complexity around the scaling, right, and the partitioning, we're just taking away. We're going to manage that automatically because I'm sure we're partitioning under the covers.
Yep. Right? Totally.
We're just doing it on the fly, which, man, that's awesome because that's always the challenge with those, of like people screw up the partitioning or they just don't quite know how to do it or when to do it. And so moving, abstracting that is great. That's a nice feature.
Since we're on the topic of these databases, how does this compare to like a Cassandra database? Is that an equivalent fair comparison, DocumentDB and Cassandra, or are those two different kinds of databases?
Yeah, I mean, from a high level, I think they're similar. They're NoSQL versions of databases where they're not relational. From that sense, I think if you speak of it from that term, it is.
But they're not necessarily document-based. Cassandra is not...
Correct, yeah. I think you're right. Like from a high level, it's the same. But when you start delving into the details, I mean, Cassandra's got a heck of a lot more features too around configuration of the cluster and that kind of thing, which we kind of hide with DocumentDB.
Yeah, and I thought DocDB is kind of targeted at some fairly specific scenarios. I think they're the same core concepts there. But I mean, I can certainly imagine. And again, I'm not an expert on both. Either way, but I can certainly imagine some scenarios where you might find that you use both, right? I mean, it's not an either-or thing. I mean, it's like everything else, right?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, DocumentDB is schema-less, essentially, right? There is no schema.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you could lump Mongo and Cassandra and even Azure Tables and DocDB as this non-relational database thing. Mm-hmm. But like Evan said, then you got to pick your poison there about like what fits best, and look at the details of how the data is being stored, how it's indexed, and those things would probably drive it.
Okay. Well, I like this other item you put on the list here, which is the Azure Dev Test Labs, now available in 6 more regions, which is nice. I think this is a feature, and we really have to have a special show on this one, but just at a high level. This is the service that helps developers and testers quickly create environments in Azure. If they just want to test the latest version of the application, they can quickly provision a Windows or a Linux server, and there's a bunch of templates that they provide you, and you can spin that up, run your tests, run your unit tests, make sure everything works, and then kind of tear it down, And so if you want need to do like a massive load test of your new release of your code, you can put it up there, spin up like I don't know, whatever, 20 machines, run a load test, and then once you got the results, you kind of bring everything back down so you don't have to keep them running all the time. And that cool feature is now available not just in the US and Europe and the Far East like it was before, but it's also available now in the in other regions like South America, Australia, and also in the central US and North Europe. So much more coverage over there for this very cool feature.
Yeah, it's funny that this came out today because well, I guess I was today or yesterday, last couple of days, just because I was I mean not kidding, I ran into one of my colleagues in the hall today, and we were kind of recycling some machines, and he was looking for some extra RAM for his Hyper-V machine because he supports Active Directory, and his problem is he's got to be able to set up these environments with an AD domain and maybe a couple different versions of Windows in the domain to go test scenarios or see if you can reproduce failures. And he's always tearing this down and recreating it. And I was just, I didn't even think about it when I was talking to him, but I need to go follow up with him in months. Like, dude, you should look at this dev test because, yeah, and then you kind of build your template, you build your structure. When you need it, you spin it up. And then when you don't, you spin it down. Right? And looking at this service, and again, I agree with you, Sujeet, we probably need to spend some time on it one night because it looks like there's a lot of capabilities and flexibilities to help you really manage these rather than just, hey, I'm spinning up a VM and configuring it.
Yeah, I mean, when I first read about this service, at a high level, it just looks like, okay, it's got, VM scale sets, a bunch of templates, and you're kind of, spinning up and spinning down various machines. But it sounds like that's all kind of automated and packaged in a different way, right? It's not just a bunch of VMs that you're, because I mean, we all know we can use scale sets to do that. But there's got to be some more to it than just spinning up a bunch of machines.
No, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
Yeah, I think one that goes along with that, I don't know if you guys caught this one, but some of the stuff we've been working on the marketplace side was this thing called CloudTry. So it kind of goes a little bit along with that dev test lab thing, but basically one of our partners, Orbitera, has now built this product that allows someone, yeah, I mean, it could be anybody, but particularly usually it's like partners. They can basically cut up some space and say, hey, I'll go ahead and put this out there and allow people to spin up a VM in Azure on my dime. And then it has a nice management interface around it to allow them to say, that you can run it for 30 minutes or you can run it for an hour or a day's or whatever. And, essentially, more of like a little SaaS type offering sitting on top of Azure, but it's a good way for people if they just want to kick the tires on something and you already have it already built. They kind of fill that void there. But I think it's kind of neat that it plays along with that dev test lab thing.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Cool. And then I'm just reading. You have an item over here on the removal of RC4 from our SSL TLS Cypher suite. What is RC4? You guys know this?
Yeah, this was Evan, did you want to? Sorry.
I mean, you can cover it. I mean, but basically, I mean, RC4 is, God, I can't remember. I'm trying to remember what the timeline was, but I mean, it's been on the hit list for people that are hyper concerned about security because it's just too easy to get into these days. But the problem is that the clients can still request it, and so you could still end up with a connection that's going across using RC4 for encryption, right? So, at some point, like there's kind of two ways you can handle this. And I mean, I'm actually kind of excited to see. I know it will probably cause some pain for some end customers, but it is ultimately, I think it's the right thing for them. But you can either take the approach of you always support the old stuff and you just run the risk that something is done in an unsecure fashion, or you basically get rid of accepting a particular Cypher suite, and then a certain class of your customers is going to have to upgrade their, client, whatever the client app is,
Right.
because otherwise they're not going to be able to connect now. I can't, you know, again, I can't remember the timeline for RC4, but it's been on this list for a while as far as don't use it. We just now are finally going that extra step and saying, you know what, we're not even going to support it.
But it's so any service you put up on Azure now will not support RC4 essentially.
So this is gonna,
Or is this just
so
for
that's actually,
the government
no,
Azure
this is, no,
only?
so your question is really good. So this is, it's really a big, a good distinction between our PaaS, SaaS, and IaaS offerings. So an IaaS VM, you have control over what it allows or doesn't allow. Now, I actually haven't looked. It wouldn't surprise me if we you know, set up our default images to not accept this. But nothing stops the customer in an IaaS VM from turning that back on, right? You own your IaaS VM. Now, for PaaS and SaaS scenarios where you don't really have that control, yeah, definitely not gonna work. But for IaaS VMs, you can. I mean, I'm trying to think of some of the older ones that are like you wouldn't want to come anywhere near TLS 1, right? You could go turn that on if you want.
This whole
Although I
thing
think
is
some of the
separate.
later OSs might not even like you may not be able to turn on. But I guess if you could figure out a way to get it turned on in an OS or maybe Linux, you know, some old version, you know, some, you know, you could do it. But yeah, it's IaaS. You're kind of you have a lot more flexibility there. I don't know that I would recommend anybody do it.
But it was kind of interesting. There's a link to that blog item in the show notes, and we'll put it there. But it starts off by talking about this initiative from Microsoft to protect the government from snooping into our data. And so this is somehow kind of will make that a better, more protected system so that nobody can just try to hack into it or just watch the data on the wire, right? This is all about data in transit on the wire, and we don't want somebody to be able to somehow use some backdoor to tap the data.
Yeah, I mean, I think the if you look at the thing from Bat Smith, right, the his second sentence is really, or third sentence, I guess, is really the key, is it's use legal process and rather than technological brute force, right? RC4, you can crack with, you know, without a ton of effort, relatively speaking, based on computational speed of computers these days, and so it's just not secure from brute force, right? So.
So they're going to use this PFS, perfect forward secrecy. I love the name of that. That's really cool. Perfect forward secrecy. It's a 2048 key length cipher suite. So interesting. Okay, that's a good update. Let's see what else we got here.
Hey, one thing I didn't put in the show notes that just went out there. I don't even know if there's a blog post on this, but it's public and everything, so it's not secret sauce
Sure.
here. Actually, that's. Hang on a second. I think it is. Hang on one second, guys. I'm pretty sure this is because I saw it on the internet today, and this is huge. Like, I think it's a big thing that we should mention. Just give me one second.
These are
Wait,
some of the
while you're pulling that
challenges.
up, so that we preserve the fact that Cale still gets to come to our podcast as a Microsoft member.
That's right.
Well,
Get
so
fired
I
here.
wanted to, as always, I like the Azure SQL Database stuff, right? But basically, we're pushing some of the higher end features in terms of geo-replication down to the lower service tiers. Right? Again, we figured out how to do this at the right, you know, cost and functional level that it's going to be on all the
That's
corpus
good.
SQL
Yeah,
tiers.
I hate that every time you wanted to do that, you had to bump up to the next tier or a higher tier. Yeah, that's good.
All right. So here it is. I had to make
You
sure of it
sure?
in
You
the
sure,
retail
Kale?
portal.
You sure?
Yeah, I checked the retail portal. I'm in there right now, so
Okay.
everything's cool. It's a good thing you said that because I live in that other one and, you know, wasn't there. Anyhow, so basically the news here is the storage accounts. I don't know if you guys know about this, but we've been working on the cool and hot storage thing for blob storage. But
Okay.
we now have that as an option. So if you provision a storage account now, if you go out there and just do new storage and obviously put it in Resource Manager, the ARM mode, there's a new kind, there's a couple new drop downs. There's one that says account kind, which allows you to pick between general purpose and blob storage. And when you pick the blob storage, another option comes up under access tier for core hot storage. To basically allow you to use these new features that we're doing. That's been in the works for quite some time now, but for infrequently accessed items, you can put them in cold storage and save a ton of money. But it comes at a cost, right? So it's the balance there is if you make everything hot, it's great because access is what it is today. You know, what your throughput is and what your pricing is the same. If you go over to cool, you get much cheaper rates as long as you don't access the data often. If you start accessing it a lot, you'll actually end up paying more. So it's something you got to consider and think about. You know, if you have things that are infrequently accessed and you have petabytes of them, could be significant, you know, something to look at.
Oh,
Yeah,
I
I mean,
see. Sorry, go ahead.
yeah, go ahead, Sajid.
No, I was going to say, so just so I understand this correctly, so the data is still in, kept in a relatively, I guess, in a, you know, close to you, but you know, it's not meant to be accessed very frequently, right? You access it
That's
a few
correct.
times over a period of some time, and that's fine. But you're not allowed to. Well, you're not. If you misuse it, then you get charged the regular rate, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like your savings account, right? If you take more than, I think it's what, six withdrawals a month out of your savings account, the government says
Right,
that's a checking account, not a savings account.
that's a
You
good
pay,
analogy.
you know. But yeah, I mean, I really like this because, and again, I'm hoping that some of the tools that are out there, because I, you know, I don't know about you guys, but like we've got all our family photos and out there in the cloud. I, by the way, total side note, it was a very sad day at my house this weekend. I decommissioned my Windows Home server for good. It was painful, but it was time. But we've had our you know, mostly because we moved all our stuff to the cloud storage. But you know, like most of the stuff I'm gonna hit once a year maybe, and if that, so it'd be great to be able to push that stuff to cold storage, you know, to be able to take advantage of that.
That's good news, Kale. Thank you.
Yeah, I got a blog post, or actually not a blog post, but in our documentation,
I
it's
found the
been
Edge.com
updated.
one for you. I'm looking out for you here, Kale.
Yeah, just did a
Okay.
quick search on that.
Great. Okay, so then we had one more, I guess. Well, there's a couple more, but the kind of one not so. This is customer success stories with application insights. Well, that's just some success stories, right? We'll put a link to that in the show notes, I suppose.
Yeah.
A couple of cool things I want to talk about. One is what Kale has lined up for this weekend. Kale, you want to discuss this thing with the
Yeah,
hackathon?
sure. Sure. So, yeah, we're Microsoft is sponsoring a hackathon here. If you're in the New York region in the 11 Times Square building we have here, it's going to be on Saturday, running Saturday through Sunday, you know, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. I think. We can't be beyond 9 p.m. in the building there, but we'll be doing it 2 days there. And the ideas around building blockchain applications or what we call decentralized applications in blockchain. You know, we talked about this in past podcasts, but you know, Microsoft has some interest in this space, and we've been building some tooling around some of the things in here, around Visual Studio and how we do stuff in Azure to run the actual blockchains up there. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, I do know that we have a limit just because of how many people we can have in a building. I think there's around 56 or something tickets when I last looked, but you can just go up and register. Doesn't cost anything, and I think there is some prizes and stuff. For people that hack there, and we're going to be talking about some cool things, and we also have Consensus guys coming by from Brooklyn who work, you know, directly on these products as well.
Yeah, sounds like a
Right.
lot of fun.
Now, do they have to bring their own laptops and computers to come there? How does that work with the hardware?
Yeah, I mean, it's a typical fashion. What we'll do is essentially provide, you know, some of the core services from like a blockchain perspective. You could obviously, you know, spin up your own stuff. You could do everything yourself if you wanted to. But yeah, I mean, it's not like we have computers or anything set up. We just have a lot of tables and food and that kind of stuff.
Got it. Oh, that should be fun. Sounds good. Okay, then we'll put a link to that in the show notes then. And okay, so well, I wanted to talk about something that Evan worked on recently. You know, Evan, you know, with your role in support, you see all sorts of kind of requests, customer requests coming, and sometimes you feel like you need to roll up your sleeve and do something to help to make these customer requests a little easier to handle, right?
Yeah, no, and sometimes I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I get like I see in my head this code or this functionality, and I can't stop working on it, so I get it out of my head. So I was, we get so Azure has this concept of Azure IPs, right? These are IPs that Azure gives out to services spun up in Azure, both internal and external services. It allocates those. Well, today we don't have a way to say I want to allow my VMs to access Azure storage only, or at, like if you ever used Azure SQL Database, there's that checkbox that says allow Azure services to access my, at least attempt to log in. They won't, if they don't have a login, they can't get in. But that is leveraging that list of Azure IPs and saying, hey, if you're coming from an Azure VM or an Azure PaaS instance or whatever, then you at least have the chance to authenticate to this database. But the challenge is these IPs change all the time. New ones get added. Sometimes we remove others. Mostly it's adding stuff, but they change all the time. And today it's an XML file on a web page, which, okay, great, it's an XML file, but that means you as a customer still have to parse it and figure out what to do with it and then manage it over time because this changes potentially every week. We publish a new one every week. So,
Oh, so
I.
hold on. No, back up a minute. So you say you published it. Where does it? Where is this sitting on some public endpoint that anybody can
Yeah,
query?
so there's an MSDN page.
Okay.
Well, I don't actually, it may be TechNet, but public-facing Microsoft content, but it's just a file you can download, right,
Okay.
from the download center. And so, so great, you got the XML file, you can see that the IPs are in it, but trying to manage that on a weekly basis is tough, right? Because we have customers that say, hey, I only. I'm okay going. I want to create an NSG that allows traffic to any potential Azure IP, but I don't want it to go to an internet IP, right? But and Azure IPs are considered internet IPs from the context of an NS, a network security group, right? So what I decided to do is, and some of this was I'd been wanting to play with REST services for a while, so this was kind of a good excuse to do that, but I wrote some code that wraps the downloading the file and parsing the file and kind of aggregating it in the right structure. And then I also did the same thing for Office 365 because they have the same capability. There's a list of IPs and it changes every month. And I wrapped it in a REST API, used, figured out how to use web API attribute routing, which is you basically define your structure. And so I got to be able to define my, what my API would look like and what the data would be that comes back. And it was really, really pretty cool from that side. But then I got to layer on Azure because I deployed it to an Azure web app. And that's, I didn't have to deal with, I went to Visual Studio, go publish, it creates a new web app for me. Trivial deployment. And now this is publicly accessible. We'll put the link in the show notes. But it was really easy to write. I spent more time fighting, learning how to use web API than anything related to the Azure stuff. Right? And you think about, 5 or 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, hey, I want to put something on the public internet. Wow, that's a pain. Right? Go to GoDaddy, get, post a site, figure out how to publish your code. I've done it. It's not pretty. But the one thing that I need to work on, and by the way, if anybody in the community wants to use this API, feel free to use it. I will say, being the support guy, big disclaimer, this is I am leveraging the actual Microsoft resources, but at the end of the day, this is a service published by me. Now, my hope is if people use it, I can take that telemetry, go to the engineering team, and say, hey, we need an official API that does this, demonstrate the need for it. But I'd love to see what people do with this. I'm actually going to go build an Azure automation template that'll create NSGs for you. So you can basically, hey, given this VNet, every, once a day, spin up, check the IP list. If you need to create new NSGs, go ahead and create them. Or if you need to delete some of the other ones, go ahead and delete them. But yeah, it just becomes this auto magic, auto managing thing. And because it's a REST API, you can call it with anything that can call REST APIs.
Now, you, how long do, and I, you know, you, I know you are a developer at heart, but you don't do development regularly these days, correct?
No, correct.
And so even for someone with your background and skill set, how long do you see, like how many like hours or days did it take you to start and finish this from start to
I
finish?
mean, I would say so. I would say probably Friday afternoon, I kind of got the bug for it, and then I didn't. I did a little bit on Friday just to kind of figure out, okay, how, you know, reading up on REST API and everything, and then I did a big chunk of time on Saturday. Sorry to my wife and kids. I was a little hyper focused, and then I, you know, spent a couple of, you know, a couple hours Sunday morning, kind of just, you know, tweaking the API and writing the help documentation and whatnot to go with it. But I mean, that was probably less than 12 hours total, if not less than 10, you know, all told, to get it out, get it on a public site, get the, get to play with Swagger a little bit and stuff. They have, you know, kind of self-documenting code. And so this is a fairly, at this point, I have a website documentation, a functioning API, and the only thing I need to do now is do some web jobs to update it, you know, on a regular basis to go pull the file down on a regular basis in less than 10 hours.
Nice. Now, just to be clear, you said you created a web app or you did the API. Is that an
So
API app?
you do web, you, so you do, yeah, so API apps these days are sitting on top of Azure. I guess they're, are they called, yeah, they used to be called Azure Websites. Now it's called Azure Web Apps. So
Correct.
I probably am using the terminology interchangeably. But yeah, it's basically just a site deployed to a shared, you know, shared services, a shared environment, you know, that is running this basically, you know, I'm not sure if I totally understand the difference between web PI code and, I'm sorry, web API code and ASP.NET. There's a subtlety there that I'm not sure that I totally get.
Well, yeah, ASP.NET is typically used for HTML applications, right? And whereas the web API is used for what you just created, which is more like a REST style service or an HTTP service. I hate to use the word REST because it's incorrect. We can get caught up in that sometime, but it's an HTTP service, is what you, HTTP API is what you build, correct?
I guess the, you know, to me, I just kind of, if I see web and I see .NET, I just think ASP.NET. I know we had this conversation, you know, months back about, you know, open sourcing it and using Owen, and it really isn't ASP.NET. I get it, but that's just kind of how I feel, it feels like. But it was, I'm just using my standard .NET code to do this, deliver this, you know, web service that is easily and clearly, you know, it's funny because the first time I did it, you know, I didn't quite know how to do the API in the right fashion, and so I couldn't quite get the routing right. So I ended up having like a bunch of query variables where you do, you know, query parameters where you do parameter question mark, you know, parameter equals blah, and that really isn't what you want to do in a modern web app, right? A modern web API. So then I figured out how to do the debug attribute so I can actually build my, you know, URL structure where it's, you know, API slash 0365 IPs slash service slash Skype slash, you know, giving me the IPsix addresses, or, you know, if I want, you know, so it's an actual web API format and structure. But yeah, it was the one thing I didn't do, and I may have to look at doing it over time, is there's this, and I'd never seen it before, I just never looked, but the API management apps. Are you guys familiar with that? So the API management layers on top of your API app, and then you can actually monetize and control access to your APIs. And there's even some capabilities where you wrap these APIs where basically you're wrapping an on-premises web thing, and is you're accessing via site to site, but your end users don't know that. They just know that it's a public-facing thing, and you know, you can control, you know, how many times somebody can run it, you know, how many people have, can you, can either make them subscribe or not subscribe. Again, this, I'm not anywhere near that sophisticated with this thing, but you can, I mean, you could really get, you know, you could build a business wrapping around some API that you just make it really easy to publish.
And I think the fact that you have the, I think the what you did has the Swagger UI already slapped onto it, right?
I have to enable it. I ran into some challenges figuring out exactly how to get that to work, but I think it's really close because you're right. I think it's built in into the framework. I just have to like I have to
Well,
uncomment some stuff.
So if you can enable the Swagger stuff, then that'll make it easy for people to actually look at your API. You know, it's kind of self-documents the API for you, and it gives them like a little test harness where they can actually go and, you know, just fire off a call and see what it looks like, look at the JSON payloads and things like that.
No, it was really neat because, again, building it this way, I get JSON and XML out of the box. I didn't have to do anything to get to make those work. I got easy deployment, easy kind of management of it. And oh, by the way, I threw it in a Visual Studio Online source
Source
code.
control. Yep.
Yeah, so I have this all source controlled. I mean, trying to do all those things, 3 or 4 years ago, and I'd still be fighting. I would have had the code written, but the deployment would still be killing me.
True.
But yeah, no, it was really fun to get to. I like writing code, so it was fun to get back to that. It works, which is really cool. So.
I think the cool thing about that API management, I played with that a little with, well, I was working with somebody who was actually using it for an on-premise system. And the cool thing there too is it's not just like a straight through, like you can actually change the
Yeah,
requests, which is pretty
absolutely.
cool. You can like map stuff over to different calls. So it could be like a WCF service even.
Yeah.
It could be anything over there that you call, as long as it can respond to those requests and then, make it look like something else.
The one issue we had, I think when we talked about the API management service, so way, way, way back when, I recall the one issue with it is that it, you know, for a small developer, I think that service is a little expensive. I think the minimum cost, I think, was like $45 a month or something like that, and that's just for, you know, the kind of entry level, and then it goes up from there. That's why I asked you about the if you enable the Swagger stuff. What I've done with some of my APIs that I put out there is just like you have in, you know, web API, but I enable the Swagger, and then that gives some of the functionality. It doesn't do the whole proxying thing and the monetization thing, but it does give them that test harness, which is some of the things that the API management gives you, right? It gives you that test harness tool where you can walk up and try the API out. So at least you get that part of it and documents it for you, which is another thing that API management does. But you can do some of this stuff just by using the Swagger extension for web API. And I think if you publish it, you said you did it as a web app. There is also a separate API app, right? Web apps are made up. There's web apps, there's logic apps, there's mobile apps, and then there's API apps, right?
Yeah, but they all sit on top of web apps these
They all
days,
sit on
right?
different web apps, yeah. So
It's
if you,
just a
but
different project type, I guess.
yeah, so if you make it an actual API app in Azure, right? A specific API app. Now that has automatic Swagger. You don't have to do it. It's just an option. You just say turn on Swagger. And it enables Swagger for you automatically. So that's like another step, you know, to
Oh
make it
yeah, I'll have to
easier.
figure out how to do that because I'm looking at my deployment now. It is an API app. But I must be missing something somewhere to figure out how to turn on the Swagger stuff. But yeah, again, I mean, you're right. I mean, we're bringing a bunch of this stuff. Oh, here, there's just a link for Swagger stuff. I just didn't realize that.
Cool. Very good. So now how are users going to get access to the link? Are we going to put it in the show notes? How do we publicize that API?
Yeah, I mean, we'll put something in the show notes. I'll even put a couple of samples, so people can kind of see, what this looks like. And again, totally open to feedback. I've already gotten a couple of feedback from two people where they sent me two other Microsoft Cloud services that have their list of IPs that are not in the other two. So I'm gonna, fork the API just a little bit so that it fits in the structure I've got. But I think that's, if anybody has ideas on how they want to consume it, reach out to me directly or reach out via the podcast. If you're using it and you figure out a great way to use it, let me know. I mean, this is totally open because again, my goal is to, leverage what we hear here to go back to the Azure networking engineering team and say, we need X based on real world data. Right? This is what customers are actually doing. Go make it work. They will definitely write better code than I will. Absolutely, but it'll prove the point that this is valuable to customers.
Absolutely, yeah. And once you have some of that application insights data to back it up, you can show them, how many hits you're getting on the API, people who are
Yeah,
using it, things like that.
exactly. It's the whole chicken and the egg problem, right? We face that, in Microsoft, just the same as everybody else, right? There's only so much time in the day,
Yeah.
only so many resources, and you get this. Well, if you can prove it'll get used, then we'll build it. Well, but I can't prove it's going to get used until you build it. So this is, I just went and built it or built something, right? That'll kind of do this.
That's great. Congratulations. Great. All
It's
right.
code. I'm happy. I'm happy I wrote code.
So that's a good gap to fill in, so that people know can get a list of all the Azure IP ranges, and then they can use that to make other decisions.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. That's great. All right, Evan, thank you very much for that. And Kale, of course, thanks for all this information. Hope best of luck with the hackathon this weekend. Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.